Welcome to our corner where we talk about the Streets of Avalon role-playing game. I'm Chris.
And I'm Brett.
And today we're talking about the investigation framework, your play sheets for playing the actual investigations on a Streets of Avalon role-playing game, assuming you want to use them, which I highly recommend it.
The nice thing about the frameworks that I like about what Chris has built and how when I've seen them and looked at them, and I like they're simple, they're straightforward, they make sense to me, and not simply like... When I say simple, I mean they make a lot of sense. And the other thing that helps is that from a tone perspective, to really get a setting right, no matter what it is, be it Forgotten Realms, Greyhawk, in name your setting, doesn't matter. Or if you're younger than me, you've got settings I don't know about. But the fact is it helps to drive home that the tone of what's supposed to happen. And, you know, it's the world I build. So, and when I built it, how does Brett introduce a mystery? It's not that hard for me. It becomes second nature is a thing I've been doing, but I've also been gaming since like forever. And if you don't know how to do it, you're like, well, is what I do, would it work in this setting and so on? That's where these frameworks I think really shine, is like gets that Avalon muscle built and how this inner really make the system work for you the way it should work. That's what I think.
So the goal of these frameworks are to, and especially in this one included, is to make it easy for people to write adventures. It's basically You fill the pieces out and you'll have a scenario that you can play with your friends for your game night. The first section that I have on there is called the introduction. This is how you introduce the mystery. I mean, and you don't have to write these in order, right? You fill them in as you understand what's going on. And probably the first one that you fill out is the overview. So the overview is what's going on so that you actually know what's happening and can reasonably react when the PCs make choices.
That's a big one with a mystery or any investigative framework. If you don't have that, if you are just trying to wing the whole thing, you will find yourself, you're red herring yourself into a hole. Mm-hmm. That piece is huge. Once you have that framework, that everything else hangs off of that. Without that overview, it's going to have a hard time.
Yeah, I generally recommend that you write the introduction last. Like, just leave a blank, go through the other things first.
100%.
Once you know the overview of what's going on, then you can fill out your threats and your escalation. So threats are the dangers, the NPCs, the adversaries that are that you can leverage to cause the PCs trouble. And escalations work with the timer. That's what the escalations are for. Other dangers is another piece in here. These are other things that you have ideas for that are happening in the game or your campaign or your scenario that you can use to complicate the player characters' lives. These are usually tied to reactions or potential locations the PCs could visit. And I will talk about reactions in a second.
That reminds me a lot, just to interject real quick. So threats and one of the things I love about the listing of threats and escalations is it helps you build a level of consistency. Like, oh, all this stuff ties thematically. It's all there, right? You can have, it's all going to be in the same groove. When you've got those other dangers, that's that piece when you're like, you know, this should be a really great time to mess with Chris's character and bring back his PC's boyfriend.
Exactly.
Now's where I'm going to drop this. You know what I'm going to do? This is a great time to take Lenny's guy or Mary's girl and do this thing and make this change. Hey, they are doing this. I'm going to do this to them and bring this thing out. It's a great time to do that.
Now, I would suggest for that, writing those in the reactions. I will talk about those in a second. Mm-hmm. The next thing is the timer. So the timer is just a bunch of boxes. It's on the play sheet. It's the timer is what you use to time out the scenario, because at some point, the scenario needs to have an endpoint, and that's what causes tension. So
yes,
once you decide how long your timer is, which there's a bit of a loose formula for that. Reactions are those things that Brett was talking about. When you want to bring things in, you use those threats, those escalations, and those dangers. That's when reactions are the things when people roll really badly, or you see an opportunity, or the timer hits a certain time. And you have markers on your timer to let you know when you get a reaction. So therefore, you aren't just letting the game go. Like, the way that the game is played is in scenes. We've talked about this before. When you have an investigation, everybody gets the chance to have a scene in a segment. So I'm like, Brett, what are you going to do? George, what are you going to do? Jem, what are you going to do? Bridget, what are you going to do? Once they all tell me what they're going to do, then we have those scenes. And sometimes those scenes can be together. Sometimes they can be separate. But after so many sets of scenes, game masters just get reactions because it just reminds you to do a thing to change the way that the pacing of the game. That's what they're there for.
The world is alive and the story is going to happen. And there's kind of an underpinning piece here where it's kind of almost like a Matt Colville. Like, if you don't explore this world fast enough, the world will come and explore you.
Correct. That's what they're for. That's exactly what they're for.
I need to keep this moving. And especially with an investigation, you need to have, or even Monster Hunting, when we talk about that later on, to ramping up the tension and pushing it towards an end, you need that, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it just seems to drag and drag and drag. And you don't want that feeling. You want to feel like stuff's happening and the place is alive.
And the one I always suggest that people just scribble down in there for themselves, and I put it in all the scenarios that I write for that will be published, is that whatever makes sense, like a reaction, so whatever makes sense in the fiction at this moment. Because sometimes that stuff will happen. You'll just be like, oh, that'd be really cool because of what just happened. I'm just going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The next set of things is the clues, because investigations have clues. So this is what I was talking about before. There are two kinds of clues that I have set up. There are flow clues and there are detail clues. Flow clues are like the trail of clues in your Trail of Cthulhu, your any of your gumshoe games. If you follow these clues, they will get you to the end of the mystery. And there's usually not that many of them. We're not looking for complicated stuff in our Streets of Avalon game. We usually only like three or four, maybe sometimes even two to five, like flow clues. But those flow clues, to get a flow clue, you have to get a number of detail clues. Now, detail clues, based off of the overview, help detail what happened and why the threat is doing what they're doing. If you've ever watched any mysteries or read any mysteries, normally when they're investigating, they start finding out what the heck's actually going on. Not how it was done, but why it was done or who had done it and their reasons for doing it. Those are those details that kind of flesh out what's going on so you can understand. Because otherwise, one of the fun things about mysteries is, do you understand what's actually going on, or did you just, you know, get to the end and solve the thing?
When I think about detail clues, it reminds me of kind of like that FBI profiling trope is like,
yep,
who did this? What did this? Why did this occur? You know, like, okay, ha, if we can find the motive, we can find the person who did it. Why did they do it? Why did she do it? Whatever. You can sort that stuff out. Excuse me. And those detailed pieces help bring all that to life. It's like, okay, I'm building my profile packet.
Yep.
Like, what is this thing? Ah, there's my target. I can go solve that problem.
The way that the game is written, you need to get so many detail clues before you get a flow clue. And it's usually the number of characters is the base one to do it. If I have three people playing, I need three clues before I get my first flow clue. Then I need three more clues before I get my second flow clue. It helps you math out your timer so that your timer actually feels like it's tense. There's also other ways that you can manipulate all this stuff. One of the design principles is flexibility.
The other thing I love about with the flexibility that we've got here, and I want to stress this, is that I can put the algebra out there. It says X plus Y equals number of flow clues, X plus Y equals timer, whatever. As you play this with your group or groups, as you go through it, you will learn that, oh, you know what they really love? Two more.
Yeah.
They really like a little bit extra. This one I could speed up. There, I could do this, I could do that. Nothing's written in stone, but a lot of times one of the things that'll happen is when you're trying to figure out tone, setting, what makes sense, how do I do this and start from a place of power, but I guess kind of like that. I want to start with a good story. I want to start with something that's solid that I can really work with. This gives you all that stuff. Yeah, you could change it, you can manipulate it, but my suggestion is go through it, and then as you get used to it, then those modifications that you're going to want to do, they will come naturally. They're absolutely going to show up.
Now, you drop these clues into buckets. You can drop them into location clue buckets. So like these clues kind of just happen in this location. You can drop them into early and late clues. Like some clues don't make sense to get early on, so you just put them in the early clues. And the reason is that you don't put them in places all the time. And that gives you the option to have floating clues. So like you know that you want to give them the idea that this person has gone missing at some point. That can be given to them in any number of ways. It doesn't have to be like mom tells you that their son went missing. You can hear it from Julius. You can hear it. You can find out by going to their house and they're not there. And you see
absolutely
a roughed up place. So those are how floating clues work. Now, because we're not writing these mysteries as we're not writing them to be read. We're writing them down to be played. So you have no idea what's necessarily going to happen. But with location clues, there are clues in locations, right? But if they're not found in those locations, you can make them floating clues if you think they're going to be useful or important later. Hey folks, Chris here. I just wanted to jump in and say we are part of the Polygamerist Podcast Network. And with that, there's some great shows in the Polygamerist Podcast Network that you might want to listen to, like the Gnomecast. Several gnomes from Gnomes 2 get together to talk about gaming topics and themselves in an effort to entertain you and avoid being thrown in the stew. But with location clues, there are clues in locations, right? But if they're not found in those locations, you can make them floating clues if you think they're going to be useful or important later.
And depending how you're, how you and your players enjoy rolling this type of thing out, one of the things that my home group enjoys is if they find a late clue early and they miss it and the world goes pear-shaped because they forgot to put the them in the proper order, they're like, ah, well, shit, that's on us. Right? Some people hate that.
Some people hate
and
that.
And there's nothing wrong with that, right? It's just like how you want to play out and so forth. And getting that concept down of a general order at the very least help. And this helps you pull together like, hey, in this space, it makes the most sense. That helps a lot.
Yeah.
It just helps you figure out where you want to put stuff. If something's missing, do I want to transition it into a floater and put it somewhere to help keep the crew moving?
Exactly. That way, at least you have the options, right? That,
yes.
That's the whole point, is to give you the flexibility to make the game happen. But there's still a game happening because there's a timer running.
Yes.
So you can't just waste time doing infinite investigation.
Which is, I'm going to love this when I run this for my group, because my buddy Zave loves to spend an infinite amount of time deciding which shade of blue the mascara was.
Yep.
So by him doing that, watching the timer tick down, the rest of the group will murder him. Fun.
Yeah, and there's like two ways you can do it. You can either just like put like squares on a piece of paper and put it out and just start marking them off. Or you could just, as things happen, you're like, you make reactions occur that are about the investigation. Like, they happened not to the player characters, but they happened to the setting. And
yes,
like, now somebody else is dead because you wasted too much time. Like,
yeah.
The next section is NPCs and locations. I usually jot down 6 to 10 NPCs and locations with short descriptions when I'm writing my notes up, that are most likely to be part of the scenario. And then I will jot down what I think the rewards probably will be, especially money. Because you need money in this game in order to pay your rent. There's a part of the game where you have to pay rent. Like, it yeah. happens. Upkeep is a thing in this game because you live in a city. You have to pay money to live in the city.
Yes. The other thing I like about with the list of NPCs, because we talked about this a little bit before in other episodes, is it's not like a huge effing stat sheet.
No.
Like back in the day. It's like, look, their name, a couple bits, a couple bobs, an attitude, and you're done.
Yeah.
Not everybody, you don't need to do the voice. You don't need anything special. You can narrate it. You could say they speak in a nasally tone. They speak they stutter and stammer a lot. They do, you know, however you want to break it out, it's fine. But that list that of 6 to 10 we're talking about, 10 may sound like a lot, but remember, this isn't a full character sheet, not even an NPC sheet, like in the back of a Call of Cthulhu or anything like that. It's very small.
The other thing that's happened to me as I've been running these things with these sheets, it's nice when I have the clue lists, because sometimes I'll look at them, I'm like, oh, I'll just make up a clue that actually makes sense here that I didn't think of, but it fits in this situation. And I know some people will hate that, right? Like, to be like, you should just write the location with the clue in the location and whatnot, but I don't actually think that's how role-playing game mysteries function best.
The thing of it is, if I was writing it as a whodunit novelette, whatever, and I was going to give it to Chris and you're going to read it, you're like, oh yeah, this makes sense, right? Or I've got to have flashbacks or whatever it is. I've got to do an Ocean's 11 where they're back and forth in time and they're bipping, bopping all over. I could do that. I could figure out how to do that narratively. But the other piece is that your players are wicked smart and we're still collaborating with each other, right? I'm a player running the game. You're the players who happen to be running PCs. If a really kick-ass idea shows up at the table by one of the players, I am a fool not to at least think about, that's a good clue. That's a dang good idea. I like that. That replaces X, or that can get added in. There's no reason not to do that sort of thing. And I think if you, strictly according to Hoyle, as my mother would say, it's perfectly bam, 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 bam. That's too scripted.
And
people will feel they will feel very railroaded if that's like, I didn't get clue number 2 in the proper order, so that's why we failed. Really?
Yeah.
Feels bad.
I mean, I got some of the idea from the Car from Grindelwald games, right? Like that, those clues are all floaters. Essentially, they're all floating clues that you can just drop in wherever it makes sense. I like that a lot for that game, but I think it's worth it to be like, it makes sense for these clues to be in this location, right? It makes sense for this person to know these things. So you can just define those things. But if you have a bunch of clues that you don't have defined, but you'd like to just make sure that you have enough that you can give out, then you just put them in the floating clues.
Especially details. Even if you're not talking about the big ones, you're talking about even if you want to be more malleable.
Yeah.
Some of the detailed clues are great places to go for. Like, hey, wouldn't it be, says player X, if this, that, and the other thing? Like, yep, totally makes sense. Go do that. Here's
a clue.
Here's a detail for you.
Mm-hmm.
it's a good reward. You know, and speaking of rewards, the other piece that we talk about at the top of this thing, we said, hey, write the introduction last. Like, how do I introduce this thing? The reward is something, in my opinion, you need to put some decent thought into, because that's the reason you're involved. Is it because I need to get paid? I want money. It's you killed my father, prepared to die.
Mm-hmm.
Is it my best friend is missing? Is it, hey, that's a kid. Yeah. I will not take that. Those, or whatever that is, it has to be something that the characters need, want, desire. Think about that stuff. Because if it's just like, hey, there's a bounty out for this, and if they give two shits about that, they will half-ass their way through your investigation.
That is
true.
They're
not invested.
One of the more recent scenarios that I put together, the character that comes and asks them for their help, especially if they're a new character and you haven't had a chance to like seed them in a previous scenario, mm-hmm. you just put it in there like, oh, this person was your friend for a long time and they bailed you out of a bad situation and you owe them a favor. What did they do to bail you out?
Exactly.
Like, that's written in to a thing, right? Like, I wrote that in there so that you could ask somebody that question, so it actually makes it, you connect it to them. And I know it seems a little ham-fisted sometimes and people get sketchy about stuff like that, but I love doing stuff like that because it does the thing that you said, Brett. It creates instant connection to the scenario.
There's a beautiful thing that Dungeon Crawl Classics does when you grab a lot of their adventures, like, hey, look, you're here to do a thing. Go do it. And it absolutely fits the DCC model. Like, boom, you're right in the middle of the thing, right? So it fits the game system, how Goodman Games wants it to run, so forth. What we're telling you here is that when you do this, if you build this introduction so that rewards mean something to your characters, whatever they may or may not be, and they could, one character might want the cash, another person doesn't care, they want the favor, the other person is just going to pay their debt, thank God, mm-hmm. by doing this favor for someone else. And when that introduction comes in, you're like, hey, this is, I was in the same orphanage with her.
Yep.
We always promised we look out for each other. Oh my God, I haven't seen you forever. Your mom, you found your mother and she's a witch. Oh my God. Whatever the deal is, by drawing that in and the way our characters are built and everything else in here, it's collaborative and I want to work with you. And if the players are doing their part, they're going to jump into that. And it's like, look, you came here to play Streets of Avalon, kids, play the game.
Yeah.
Right. As a player, get in it. You know?
I just want to try to give you real narrative reasons to go do the thing.
100%.
If you're the game master and you see better ways to like blow it in there, like that thing that I talked about, I didn't have to do that because I just made that one of the characters has been looking for their brother for like 5 months. I've actually been looking for their brother for like the entirety of the game there since they got separated when they were like six. But our game time was like 5 months. Finally, this guy's girlfriend shows up, and that character that I mentioned wasn't there because they owed him a friend. They were there because they were that character's brother's girlfriend. And they're like, I know where your brother is. There now, instantly easy. Like, so if you have those things that you can just shift a little bit, you should just do that.
Yeah, I will tell you where your brother is. I just need you to do this first.
Well, I will tell you where your brother is, because if you don't go and get him, he's going to get murdered.
That also absolutely works. Excuse me. That's awesome. I love it.
That was my reverse heist. Well, they had to go steal a person from a bunch of masks.
So I know there's a ton of different games out there that will give you ideas of how to run investigations, clues, and so forth. Got one you really like, hey, I know how to do X, Y, and Z. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, just go do that if that's what you want to do. I built this for this game. Although this system that I built could be transferred to other games. I know because I've done it.
Yep. You and I have talked about that. What I want to get at here is that the reason we've got it here is because one of the things that Chris and I both know is very important is like, how do I make sure that Avalon feels like Avalon when you're running it? And this layout is how you get the Avalon tone, look, feel, smell, taste, all of that stuff for an Avalon investigation is the recipe. Now, anybody who's cooked at a certain point, or if you're a baker and you know your chemistry, you know how to make those cookies even moister. You know how to make that stew a little bit more something, right? You're going to try it. You're like, ooh, I know what I need. Needs more whatever. You're going to get that. And this is a good recipe to start with. It's going to get you a strong, strong base you can work with.
Those reactions will give you that very noir feel.
Absolutely.
Well, that's all I got, Brad. That was fun. Why don't you tell me about another one of your stories from one of your investigations?
Thank you for listening to Under the Lamplight, the Streets of Avalon role-playing game podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please follow or subscribe on whatever podcatcher you listen to this on. If you'd like to get the playtest book or keep up with the ongoing development of the game, check out thestreetsofavalon.com, our home for all your Streets of Avalon content. and we'll see you under the lamplight next week.